Last time, we talked about briefly the importance of searching and the related topic of sorting. And today I want to talk about, first before we get to actual writing programs, talk a little bit about methods for searching. We'll analyze them, and then we'll look at methods of sorting. So let's start with searching. Suppose you have at home a whole collection of books on your shelf. I imagine most of you probably did not take the trouble to sort your books alphabetically on your shelves at home. And you are looking for a particular book. Or, for example, you've pulled a sock out of your drawer and you're looking in the drawer for the matching sock. What might be your strategy for finding the item? You pick out a sock at a time, compare it with the one that you're looking for, until you either find the one you want, or you get to the end and you know that the washing machine ate up the sock and it's gone. Similarly with books. The books in your house, jumbled on the shelf. You look for the first book. That's not the one you want. You look for the second book. That's not what you want, and so on. That is called a linear search. Now, of course, there is a common feeling amongst us human beings that when it's late to school and you're looking for the sock, the matching sock, somehow or other that sock is smart enough and it crawls, digs its way in, so it's the last thing you look for. Now, you all have that feeling, right? Whenever you're looking for something, it's always the last thing you're looking for. Okay? Whenever you come to a red light, it's always red. It's never green. Okay? Now, is that really true? Does the sock really know, have intelligence and burrow its way in? The answer is, of course not. Except that human beings are pessimists. We remember the bad times, we don't remember the good times. All the times that you reached into your drawer to find the sock and it came up right away, that sort of slips your mind. What you remember is when you were late to a meeting, came to the light, and the light was red. And it seems that's always, like the light has something against you. Now, if you did an experiment, and for the next month, every time you drove and you came to the light, and you marked down it was red or it was green, you would find, not 50-50, because the lights are not, usually they're, you know, maybe a little bit more to one street than to the other, but they would certainly be in proportion. It's like flipping a coin. If you flip a coin, you're not guaranteed that every other coin will be heads, tails, but if you flip enough of them, you would find that 50% of the time, heads or tails. So we need to, and the same thing is true, of course, with socks and books, okay? You're looking for a particular book that you want to read. You forget all the times that you've reached to the shelf and found it right away. You only remember the times that you had to go through everything before you found it. You look for keys, your keys, you left your keys somewhere. You forget all the times that you knew exactly where the key was. You picked it up and found it right away. You just remember the time you were late for a meeting or to go somewhere and you had to search the whole house for your keys. You always remember, we're pessimists. So we need to analyze the algorithm, the linear search routine a little bit more carefully than just what our psychological makeup makes us believe. So let's consider the linear search. And what we're talking about now is a process called analysis of algorithms. Analysis of algorithms is a very, very important topic because, as you're going to even see today, choosing the right searching technique can make the difference between having a totally impossible task to one that is extremely efficient and easy to do. Analysis of algorithms can be done mathematically. It could also be done, as we're going to do today, a little bit less mathematically. And it's a very, very important topic, and it's one of the required courses in the major. CIS 23 is a course that deals with analysis of algorithms. Let's assume for a moment that we have N items, like 1,000 items, and you do a linear search. So when you look at the first item, how many items have you eliminated from that search? One item, right? So you have, in other words, 999 to go through. And when you looked at the second one, you have 998 things left to go to. And if there was 1,000,000 items, okay, when you looked at the first item, you still only eliminated one item. On the average, how many items would you have to look through until you find the thing that you want? that number from?
I divided it by 2.
You divided n by 2. Because it makes sense. It's just as likely that the first item is the one you want as it is the last item. It's just as likely as it's the second item you found as it would be the next to last item. So on the average, it would be n divided by 2. It's the average. Okay? What would be the worst case? The worst case scenario. That's the last item. That you would have to look through n items. And if there was the Manhattan phone book, 8 million items, and it wasn't sorted, and you had to do a linear search, on the average, you'd have to look through 4 million items before you found the one you looked for. You can see that that's very impractical. Every time you looked up a phone number, you'd have to look through 4 million items on the average before you found it. And if the Manhattan phone book directory grew to 16 million items, then on the average, you'd have to look through 8 million items before you... In other words, as you can see, as n gets larger and larger, okay, the searching becomes very, 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 very inefficient. The only reason that you use linear search for your socks at home or for your books at home is because you don't have very many books. You don't have very many socks. You don't have very many clothes in the closet as you look through one at a time for the one that you want. If you had so many books, like a library, the linear search would not be an efficient technique. What we say, since when n gets very, very large, n over 2 is roughly n anyway, okay, it depends on n, we use the word, it is on the order, we call this big O notation, of n. We say that this linear search depends directly on the size of the file. The larger the file, the more items you're going to have to look for. Very, very inefficient. And certainly, unless n is small, linear search is impractical. Let's look at another technique. That notation, by the way, O of n is called big O notation, because it uses a capital O, and you will spend in CIS 23 a whole semester learning how to find that and how to use that. Today I'm just mentioning it sort of off the cuff. Now let's think of a better technique. Let's take the Manhattan phone book. And suppose you're looking up a particular name. Let's say you're looking up for my name. Can you tell me what is the best strategy you could do? The phone book is open, is closed on the shelf in front of you. What's the first thing you're going to do besides take the phone book off the shelf? Open it up, good. To where? To the middle. That's correct. Now, some people would argue that if the person's name starts with an A, you might start open it up sort of near the front. If someone's name starts with a Z, you might open it up near the end. But that means that you have to know something about the distribution of names in the United States. If you were in some foreign country, would say, where most of the names started with the letter Z, then your strategy of opening it up to the end would not do you any good. And that's also true. When we talk about searching and sorting, if we know some additional information about the data that we want to search through, sometimes we can make great improvements on the searching technique. But at least in this class now, we're assumed that we have no information whatsoever about the distribution of, the, say, the last names in the phone book. And therefore, the right technique is to open to the center. And what do you do then? And compare, which last name?
L.
Well, yeah, my L. But in the phone book, what you would do is open it to the center and look at to see if the center name is the one you want. Highly unlikely, but possible. Let's say it's not the one that you want. Then you ask yourself, is the name that I'm looking for greater than the one in the middle? And if it is, you can reject the whole lower half of the phone book. And then you take the upper half of the phone book and split that exactly in middle. And look at the middle name. And you say, is that the one I want? Maybe yes, probably not. If it's not, you say to yourself, is the name I'm looking for greater than the one that I'm looking at? If the answer this time is no, you reject the upper quarter of the phone book, and now you just have the third quarter to look through. And you repeat that process. That technique, until you get down to one page, then you say, is it on this side, on this side, then you say, that's called the binary search technique. Now, the binary search technique is an amazingly mind-bending, powerful technique. Let's think about this for a moment. If you had 1,000 names to look through, after the first search, you've eliminated 500 items. If there was 8 million items on the first search, you already eliminated 4 million items. Unlike this one, in which the elimination of looking at one only eliminates one, no matter how many there are left, in the binary search, each search eliminates half the items that are left. Okay? Now, the question is, then, what is the worst case for the binary search? Suppose you had 8 million names. The Manhattan phone book, let's say. What is the worst possible case to search through 8 million names? Can anybody tell me? Believe it or not, you would never have to look through more than 24 names. That would be the worst possible case. In fact, the binary search is so powerful that there's usually a little party game that you can sometimes play. You can walk over to a shelf of books and tell someone, pick a word in any one of the books, don't tell me where it is. And I can guess that word in under 20 yes-no answers. And you just walk over to the middle shelf, you point to the middle book. Is it to the right or the left of the middle? Then if they say it's to the right, then you go to that half, point to the middle, right or left. Get down to a single page. Now, how can I prove this to you that it takes no more than 24 searches in 8 million? Now, did I tell you this business of folding paper yet? Did I tell you that story? No. So I'm going to tell you a little story now. For that, I need a sheet of paper. Okay. Here's an ordinary sheet of paper. There's nothing up my sleeves. Okay? And I fold it in half. No big deal, huh? And I fold it in half again. No big deal, right? Okay, how many times can I continue folding it in the same direction? You think so? Right. Anybody have a different answer? The answer is no matter how hard you try, you won't be able to fold it more than 8 times. No matter how hard you try, because every time you fold it, it's getting thicker and thicker. And you will see physically, all in the same direction, physically, you will never be able to fold it more than 8 times. Now, so someone says to me, okay, well, don't start with a fat piece of paper. Take a piece of tissue paper. Single ply. You'll find the same thing is true. In fact, I tell students, take a roll of toilet paper, unroll it down the hall, and you will find that it's still true. Because the bigger the paper is, each time you fold in half, you're folding over more at a time. And you will convince yourself that it's not possible, no matter what sheet of paper. That's good. Hands-on is always very good. But you certainly can do it in your mind. Can we do a thought experiment? Can we think about folding a paper 50 times? So what do you say, huh? You think so? That's right, you can't. But can we do it in our mind? Can we think about folding the paper 50 times? So let's do a thought experiment. Suppose it was physically possible. It's not. Trust me, it's not. But let's say it was. And let's say I started out with a piece of paper that's 1,000th of an inch thick. Now, the first question to ask is to test your intuition. Some people have good intuition, some people have bad intuition. Okay? What do you think? Is this paper more or less than 1,000th of an inch thick? More. How would you estimate that? How would you come to that conclusion? Well, if this was 1,000th of an inch thick, that means that 1,000 sheets would add up to 1 inch. Now, you know what a ream of paper looks like for a Xerox machine. A ream of paper has usually 250 or 500 sheets in it, and it's about 2 inches thick. Or you buy a loose leaf. How many sheets does a loose leaf have? And you see how thick it is. Therefore, this sheet of paper is a lot more than a thousandth of an inch thick. A thousandth of an inch thick is very, very, very thin toilet paper. Okay, really, really thin. Where a thousand sheets would add up only to 1 inch. But let's imagine that the sheet of paper was a thousandth of an inch thick. Can we imagine that in our mind? So if I fold it in half, how thick would it now be? This is not a trick question. So how thick would it be? 2/1000th of an inch. 1/500th of an inch. Very good. And if I fold it again in half, it would now be... what would it be? It would be 4/250ths, right? I mean, it would be 4/1000ths, which would be 1/250th of an inch. Correct? Okay. What happens if we did this 50 times? Okay. How thick would it be? Now, I'm not asking for an exact number, and I know you know the answer, so... do you think it would be more than an inch thick? Now remember, 1,000 sheets of paper would add up to 1 inch. If you fold it over in half, I said 50 times, would it be more than an inch thick? What does your gut tell you, yes or no? You could be wrong. You would say yes, more than an inch. Okay. Everybody agree with that? You would say more than an inch. The rest of you are just have no convictions. Okay. Would it be more than a foot high? Still willing to tolerate maybe more than a foot? You don't think so? You think maybe. What do you think? Possibly. Would it be more than from the floor to the ceiling? This ceiling. Would it be more than a mile high? No. Huh? For sure not. Definitely not. Definitely not. Definitely, right? Definitely. What happens if I tell you that it goes from the earth to the moon and back? Would you believe me? Well, let's prove it. So what I'll do in order to prove it to you is I will use Excel just to do the math. But when you're in a boring class, you can do this math on your own. Okay? And it's really very simple. So let's just do the math. Start up with Excel. PowerPoint. Soft off of this. Excel. Okay. Let's make some headings to make this neat. Number of folds. Okay, let's move over here and write thickness. Let's not do it, small thickness. And let's put the zero fold before it was even folded. It was, we said, 0.001 of an inch. Is that correct? Fair enough? I want to make sure that you know I'm not cheating here. Okay. Now I'm going to fold it 50 times. So I'm going to put the number 1 over here. And just in Excel, instead of having to write down the numbers 1 to 50, I can simply do this up to 50. Oops. And it fills in the numbers for me. Very nice. Okay. So I have the numbers 1 to 50 in this column. Now, what would be the thickness in after one fold? You would double it. Correct? In other words, instead of doing it by hand, let me take advantage of the computer to say that this would be equal to 2 times... this. And that's what you expect, 0.002. There, you're double. Yes? I don't know, that's English. That's math. I don't know about math yet. Your gut feeling, yeah, well, but your gut feeling, I asked you if it's a mile high, and your gut told you absolutely not. Now you're beginning to think maybe he knew what he was talking about. Okay? Now it's just saying exponential. Oh, yeah, you learned something in mathematics, exponential. Well, let's verify that, in fact, the mathematics is true and how wrong your gut feeling is. Okay, so I doubled it. Okay, it's so big, it's now... now, this is in inches. So let's convert from inches to feet and then into miles. How do you convert? Let me put it over here. If you want to convert something from feet, from inches to feet to miles. So what do? I take this number and I divide it by 12, and I take that result of that and divide it by, anybody know? 5,280. And that's miles. And just so that we can format that and see that in a form, let's format that number into number, and we don't need to show any decimal places, okay, but we will use commas, and that is 17,769,884.89 miles. Okay? And of course the answer is yes, it's exponential. And yet why does that bother you so much? Why is that uncomfortable? And it grew so huge. And why is that an why did your intuition, women's intuition or not, why did your intuition mislead you so badly? And the reason is because there's nothing in life, in real life, that is really exponential in our day-to-day experiences. And intuition is just applying something for which you have experience with to something new. Think about it. You had a test and you failed. You got a 0 on the test. And you studied real hard, and on the next test you got a 50. And then you studied even harder, and on the next test you got 100. If you study any harder, would you get a 200? No. Let's say there was someone who was grossly overweight. So overweight that they can't even be on the television show Who's the Greatest Loser. Okay? They're in the news, they weigh 1,000 pounds. So you know the fire truck department has to come and carry them around. And they decide enough is enough, and they're going to get their stomach stapled, and they're going to get their mouth wired shut and be fed only by IV. And after a year goes by, they've lost half their weight. They're now 500 pounds. Oh, wow. Man loses 500 pounds. It's all over the news. And they keep this up for another year, and they lose another half of their weight. So they're now down to 250 pounds. And the guy says, well, this is so good. Let's do it for another year. And he's now down to half of that, which is 125. And the guy says, I'll do it again and be down to half of that. Because the next time you'll be, the only time you'll be less than that is when you're in the grave and the worms get you. Okay? Never. Think about this. You walk into Atlantic City with $100. You put it down on a table and you make $100. So now you have $200. Okay, that happens. Everyone goes, ooh, wow, wonderful. So you put the 200 down again and you make $400. By now everyone's standing around and watching you. And you put down the $400 and you make $800. What happens then? The guards come and escort you out for cheating or card counting. Okay? Think about what happens with stocks. Do you ever double your profits? You buy stocks. It goes up, you put in 100, you make 200. Okay, that occasionally happens. You put the 200 in again, you make 400. That occasionally, very rarely, but occasionally happens. You put it in again, and you make $800. What happens then? The Securities Exchange Committee arrests you for insider trading. Normally we expect profits of 10%, 20%, 30%, not 100%. There's nothing in life for which we can draw an experience on about this doubling business. So let's look at another possibility. Let's look at another little story. Here's a deal I got for you. Maybe one that you would want to use on your significant other, whoever it is that gives you your allowance or your salary. So we have like this. How many days does April have? 30 days, right? 30 days. 30 days have September, April, June, and November. So the rest of 31. April is already in the middle. So I'm going to wait until April, May. Okay. So I'm going to go over to my significant other and I'm going to say, I have a deal for you. On May 1st, give me a penny. On May 2nd, give me 2 pennies. And on May 3rd, give me 4 pennies. Do this for 1 month. And I promise never, ever, 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 ever to ask you for money again. Is that a good deal? Should you do it? Or should your significant other do it? How much money do you think you would have on the worst day of the month? What do you think? I would have a penny. And that's math. I don't know what 2 to the whatever means anyway. You don't have a calculator, so it won't help you any good. What does your gut feeling tell you? $1,000, $10,000, $1 million? What do you think? Again, when we have something with which we have no experience, the only way to do it is to actually sit down and do the calculation. That's a very important lesson for scientists. Okay? Your everyday experience sometimes fails you dramatically when you talk about very, very large number of atoms, for example, in a cup of water. Such a bizarrely large number that nothing in our everyday life can give us any feeling. So unless you do the math, your intuition will lead you wrong. That's the point of doing experiments, okay, and doing it mathematically. Because otherwise, you're definitely going to your conclusions, your biases. We'll do something similar we did before. Let's put day over here. Let's put money over here. Let's put May 1 here. Okay, let's put May 2 over there, okay, and then Excel is smart enough to know the calendar, so I'll go down right until May 31st, okay, I'm not adding any days. I'm going to start with 0.01 over here, and just let's make this, in preparation, let's make this currency format. So since we're talking about dollars and cents, let's just make it currency. Okay, so it'll look nice. Okay? And what do we have on the second day? On the second day, we're going to ask for double what we had the day before. So it's 2 times the day before, which of course is 2 cents. Now, copy that down. So let's copy it down until the 10th day of the month, a third of the way through the month, $5.12. Maybe you made a bad deal after all, and maybe your significant other is feeling a little happy. So you say, oh, let's try it out a little bit further. Let's go down to the two-thirds of the way through the month. Okay, getting a little worried there because I didn't go far enough. Let's go down till the 20th of May. Okay, on the 20th of May, they have to hand you $5,000, but the end of the month is in sight, and before long, they'll never have to bother with you ever again, which might be a good thing. Good deal? Take it down to the 30th day, column a little bit lighter, and on the 31st day of the month, they have to hand you $10 million. Now, 1 minute. You're not giving back all the rest of the money either, are you? So let's add up how much money you've made. Simple formula here, we have a summation, the order of sum, say okay, and that's $21 million you've made. Another property of these exponential functions. The exponential function is that they start out slow, grow slowly, but they rapidly grow very, very quickly. Which brings us back to our conclusion. What would be the worst possible case in the binary search? Well, that's just the reverse, in a sense. What I need to do is I need to ask myself, starting with one item, okay, let's double it. In other words, let's make this the same formula, equals to 2 times this. Okay. Let's go down until we hit 8 million. You know what? Let me make this whole column, again, numbers, so it'll be easier to read it. Let's make it number format with commas. Okay. Okay, I need to make this a little, that's 2 million. That would be 4 million. That would be roughly 8 million. That means if I go backwards, start here. Remember the binary search. After one search, I've eliminated half, so I'm down to 4 million. After another search, I've eliminated another half, so I'm up to only 2 million things left, and so on. And all I need to know is how many numbers there are, and that's 24. See, it's on the 24th row. So on the worst possible case, looking through 8 million items, you would never need to look through more than 24 searches, as opposed to the linear search that you'd have to look through 8 million things. And what's interesting is that if the Manhattan phone book suddenly doubled, that there was now 16 million people living in Manhattan, so the whole island would sink into the ocean. But let's say there were 16 million people. The worst possible case would be only 25, only one more. You see how powerful the binary search technique is. Okay? And obviously, that's the technique that's used to search through very, very, very large number of items, because no matter how impractically large they are, the binary search lets us find the item we want in relatively very, very, very small number of steps. Now, writing the binary search in C++ is a little too complicated for this class right now. So we won't do it, but you will take, when you take a course like CIS 22, which is a data structure course, that's one of the things you'll be looking at, is how to write such an algorithm. What I want to turn my attention to now is what we need to do in order to be able to do the binary search. What do you have to have in order for the binary search to work? Why can't you do the binary search on your socks in your drawer? Why can't you do the binary search in the books on the shelf? They need to be in order. They've got to be sorted. So why don't you sort the books on your shelf? Why don't you sort the socks in your drawer? It's time. It's not worth the effort. Think about it. When you have, let's say you have lots of novels at home. Let's say you're a big paperback reader. You read lots and lots of novels. And they're piling up on the shelf. How often are you going to want to reread a book that you've just read? Rarely, because you know the ending already. It's very rare. In other words, you're very rarely going to be searching. Okay? On the other hand, look at your socks. Yes, you need socks every day. But how many socks do you have? It's just not worth the effort of laying them out color-coded in order. And I do know that some people color-code their clothing in the closet, but no one sorts them by designer label. At least not that I know of, unless you're nuts. Okay? Because it's not... That's a good strategy. Now, on the other hand, in the library, where people are always looking for things, they take the trouble to sort. In other words, you don't get anything in life for free. If you want to have efficient searching, then you have to take the trouble to sorting. But if you don't need to search very often, then why waste your time sorting the occasional time that you'll need to find something? You'll just take the time to do it. And that actually is a very good thing you can tell your mother when she yells at you, why aren't you cleaning your room? Because mathematically, it's not efficient for you to clean your room. Since you probably don't look for things too often in your room. Okay, because mother always goes in there and cleans the laundry anyway and puts things away. So why should you have to do all the work? Okay, in other words, you have to make a judgment with an algorithm. Which of it pays more often? Should I take the trouble to sort or should I take the trouble to search? Can't have it easy both ways. In any event, we're going to now talk about a little bit about sorting. Turns out, life is not easy here either. There are many, many, many different ways to sort something. And there is no single best way. There are some situations where one technique is better. In some situations, another technique is better. If you know something about the data ahead of time, you can choose a better sorting technique. There's probably about 200 different sorting techniques, of which about 25 of them are pretty useful and used quite often. And that's why there is an entire graduate course called Sorting and Searching, where you spend the whole semester learning different sorting techniques. We're going to look at one particular sorting technique called the bubble sort. Turns out the bubble sort is generally a pretty lousy sorting technique, except it's rather easy to write the program to do so. So, although it's not a very good sort, and I would not use the bubble sort for anywhere for large numbers, more than 1,000 items to sort, okay? But for generally small items, 100 items, 50 items, it's pretty efficient for small items, and it's rather easy to understand how it works. So before we write the code for it, let me work it out with you on the board, and then we'll write the code. So let me do it here, so that we can then compare the code to what really happens. Let's imagine for a number, that for example, that I have the following items to sort. 25, 57, 48, 37, 12, 92, 86, and 3. You know, instead of making it 3, let me make it 33 for a reason. That will come clear later. Okay, I don't know if you can see the 33, so I'll move this out of the way. Okay, let's start the following. I'm going to have my two fingers. And I'm going to ask myself, are these two in order? And what's the answer? Yes. So I'll peep the 25. And then I'll ask, are these two in order? The answer is no, so I'll switch them. And then I'll ask, are these two in order? And the answer is no, so I'll switch them. The 57 here. Are these two in order? No, so I put a 12 here and the 57 is here. Are these two in order? So I'll leave the 57 and move over. Are these two in order? No, so I'll switch them around. 92 and 33, are those two in order? So I will switch them around and put the 92 here. Now let's stop for a moment and consider what's happening. I've gone through this, all the numbers, one time, one pass. I've passed through the numbers. This is what we call pass number one. By the way, how many numbers do I have? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So N here, the number of numbers, is 8. How many comparisons did I have to do? How many times did I say, are these two the same? Are these two the same? 7. In other words, on pass number 1, I did N minus 1, or 8 minus 1, or 7 comparisons. Correct? What can you tell me has happened after the first pass? What are you guaranteed has happened after the first pass? Do you come to any conclusion? Before we get to that, what can you conclude? Why do you say that? The largest number is guaranteed to have moved up to its to the top. Like a bubble. The biggest bubble comes up first. Which means that this number is in its proper spot. And I don't have to look at it again. So the next time around, on pass number 2, I just ignore that. This time I'm going to look at these two, they're the same. These two, switch them. 48 and 12, switch them. 48 and 57, that's fine. 57 and 86, that's fine. 86 and 33, switch them. So on the second pass, in which I've only had to do 6 comparisons, I will never again have to look at that number. Now, by the way, you realize that I'm writing each line over and over again so you can take notes. What really is happening is I have an array, which I'm just drawing sideways this time, and what I'm doing is I'm just switching things in the slots. I'm just drawing you the array as it looks each time so you can follow along. But what's really doing is I'm switching them in the box. So these are really in place. Does everyone see that? Now, let's continue. Pass 3. These are fine. This needs to be switched. These are fine. This is fine. This and this is not fine. Again, on the third pass, I no longer have to look into the 57. Another time. 25 and 12. 25 and 35. 35 and 48. 48 and 33. Switch them. Never have to look at this one. Each pass, I have fewer and fewer things to look through. 12 and 25. That's fine. 25 and 35. That's fine. 35 and 33, need to switch them. Again, 12 and 25, that's fine. 25 and 33, that's fine. Is there any point in going on at this point? Why not? Because I went through a pass, and I had to make no changes this last time around. And it just happened to be that way. But what happened? If you go through a pass, suppose when I went through this pass, I noticed that there was nothing that needed to be switched. I could stop right there, early. In other words, I can, at worst, keep on going one more time. Okay, in other words, 12 and 25, I don't have to look at this anymore. 12, 25, that's fine, okay. So there's, at worst, I'm going to have to go through 7 passes. But I could, this case, I was able to save myself one pass, because on this pass over here, there was nothing to switch. And if there's nothing to switch, it means everything must be already in order, and I can stop. Okay? By the way, can you tell me a formula for telling me how many comparisons I had to make over here? Remember, this is pass number three, right? So if I take N minus pass 8 minus, in this case, 3 is 5. This one was pass number 2. N minus pass is 6. Does anyone see here the beginning of a for loop? Okay? We have a big loop that goes around at most N minus 1 times. And on each pass, we need to compare N minus pass items. Correct? Well, let's look at the code. What you should do at home is draw yourself a little array, fill it up with some jumbled numbers, go through the logic to make sure you understand how this occurs. And we're going to now look at the code that does the bubble sort. Now, this is the only algorithm the whole semester you have to memorize. They will ask on a final, they could ask you on the final to write the bubble sort from memory. So either you memorize the algorithm or you understand it so that you can write it from scratch on the exam. Let's look at the bubble sort. You have a copy of it. And it's not surprisingly called bubble sort. Let's look at the main program. The main program, I'm going to assume that I have a data file called numbersdata.txt. I think you have a copy of that file somewhere. Right? You had it earlier on in the semester, I think. It was just a bunch of numbers. We can open it. Let's look for it. Let's open it just to show you that it exists. Okay? Those numbers certainly are not in any particular order. Correct? Jumbled? What I want to do is I want to run this program. Good. So it's out of order. You want more numbers out of order? Let's make this 32. Let's make this 15. Okay? Only thing is that if I mess this up, oh, what the heck, mess it up. We'll fix it up later. Okay, is it messy enough for you now? So let me now save that file. Okay, it's saved. Let's get rid of it. Let's now build this. Let's now run it. What I want to do is I want to open the file. Okay, and then what I want to do is to print them out in sorted order. So let's just run it. And as you can see, they're now sorted. Okay? That's what I want to do. Now, I don't know ahead of time how many numbers there are going to be. You know what? Just so that I don't screw this up for the next time I teach this class, let's go back and put the numbers in the way they were once I convinced you that I'm not cheating. So what were the numbers? Who's got the... There was, I think, 2, 4, 6. This was an 8. 14. And this was a 16. Now I will save this, and now I'll close it, and let's run it just again, just to show you, and now it sorts these numbers in order. Makes no difference how unsorted it is. Now, as it turns out, that's not quite true, because when you'll take CIS 22 and learn about different sorting techniques, some sorts work good when numbers are almost completely sorted, like this one. Some work better when everything is jumbled, and they work horrible when everything is almost completely sorted. So that's, again, different techniques for different situations, but we're just going to look at the bubble sort, and for a small number of items. Now, I'm going to, again, to assume that there's no more than 1,000 items. So let's start with the program. We did this last time, when we talked about arrays. I created const int max number equals 1,000. This was the same exact part of the program that we had last time when we were learning how to read numbers in to an array until there were no more, counting them as we go along. So the main program, before we get to the bubble sort, the main program creates some variables, I count, and the array number max number. Remember that max number is going to be from 0 to 999 slots this time. Okay. We open our file. We check to see if it is open. And here is that code that you should recognize by now. This is the code we use. I told you to put a box around this in your notes. This is the code that you use to read in numbers one at a time until there are none left, putting them into the slots of the array and counting them as you go along. Okay, does this look familiar from the previous two examples that we did with arrays? So I won't review it now. I equals zero, while infile.eof, and infile into number sub I, plus plus I, round and round and round you go. Eventually, when there are no more numbers, we drop out of the while loop, and the count contains the number of items. And we filled the array with the original set of numbers that we had. At this point, we want to call the bubble. That's the function that's going to do the sorting for us. Okay, let's assume for a moment that it works. So we'll get to discuss it in a moment. Assuming that it works, we are then going to say the array contains count elements, because we just counted it. And then we're going to say for I equals 0, I less than count, we're going to print out numbers sub I, which hopefully by now is going to be in order, if bubble did its work. And that's the end of the program. Now let's think about what bubble needs. In order for bubble to sort, what do we have to give it? We have to give it the array, and we have to tell it how many numbers are in that array. Because all we know in the program is that there could be no more than 1,000 numbers, but we don't care about all the empty slots. We only wanted to sort the slots that have been filled. So I'm sending it two parameters. Number, which is an array, and count, which is not an array. Okay, let's look at the function prototype for bubble. Compare this line with this line. In fact, I should have them both at the screen at the same time, so you can compare them. There they are. This line versus this line. Bubble is void, since all it does is does a thing. It sorts, doesn't do anything else, doesn't give me back anything. It accepts. What does int bracket mean? What does int empty bracket mean? We learned that before already. What's that a symbol for? An array of integers. And int, a number. So we're sending it an array of integers, and we're sending it a number. Does it have to know how big the array is? No. That's why it's only empty brackets. We don't have to tell it how big the array is. We just have to tell it how many numbers we put into the array. Everybody with me? So now let's look at the function itself. Void bubble int x. X is going to be now the parameter by which we refer to the array, which we called outside it, we called it number. So it's the same array with a different name. And int n. N is going to be the same thing as count. Now, apropos the assignment that you were supposed to hand in today or last time, is the bubble sort going to change N? Or should the bubble sort change N? What does N represent? The number of items, right? Is the bubble sort going to change the number of items? No. So it makes sense to you that this is not a reference parameter. It's a value parameter. Because we're certainly not going to add items to the array. We're not going to take away items from the array. So the array, the number of items in the array, the count, or n as we know it here, is not going to change. So it's a value parameter. Right? Does everyone understand that and see that? Is the array going to change? I'm sorry, is the bubble sort going to change the array? Think carefully. Is the bubble sort going to change the array? What's the bubble sort supposed to do? Come on, tell me, what's it supposed to do? Change the items in the array. So I'm going to ask the question again. Is the bubble sort going to change the array? Yes! Everybody say, yes! It's going to change the numbers of the array. Is that clear to everybody? So you would have thought that I need to put what in order to indicate that? the ampersand sign, right? The and sign, to make it a call by. But you don't see that, do you? So you should ask me, how come? If you understood call by value, call by reference, you should bother you. So here's an important rule. Arrays are always a call by reference. That is, you never use the ampersand for arrays, because whenever you change an array, it will change it in the outside as well. So indeed, looking at this, if I ask you on a test question, name me the variables that are called by value, and this you would tell me, called by value, n. And if you would say to me, and I say to you, name me the ones that are called by reference, you would say, and if you argued with me and said to me, well, 1 minute, for called by reference you need to put an ampersand, I would say to you, x is an array, it does not get the, in fact, it would be a mistake if you gave it the ampersand. It would screw everything up, and it would not do what you think it would be doing. What it does is not important right now. Okay, so now that we understand that we're going to be processing the original array, even though we're calling it x here, the loop itself is going to be quite simple, and you'll follow this at home, again with your fingers as you trace it and learn it. I will have, first of all, a flag, a variable called switched, which is a Boolean variable. Remember, that's true-false. And I will set that initially to true. You'll see in a minute why that's there. And now I'm going to say, remember I told you this is a loop within a loop, right? It's a for loop because it's going to loop around multiple passes. And on each pass, it's going to loop around doing comparisons. So it's a for loop within a for loop, nested for loop. You told me that if I have 8 items, I'm going to go make 7 passes, right? So it's n minus 1, okay? N minus 1. So therefore, we go for pass equals 0, pass less than n minus 1, forget about that and for a moment, pass plus plus. So that loop, the loop that starts here and ends here, is the loop, the outer loop, that controls first this pass, then this pass, then this pass, then this pass, and this pass. Right? Now, that would be fine, that would take me through, but we also said that there's sometimes I can short circuit and get out early. For example, when I got here, I did not have to go on one more time. As long as I did not switch something, I can stop immediately. So I'm going to have a variable called switch, which I'm going to make it false. And as soon as I switch something, I'll make it true. But if I went through the whole pass and I never switched anything, it will remain at false. And if it remains at false, when I come back here, even though this might be true, but this would be false, which false and true would make it false, and I would drop out of the loop, end early. So this little piece here is the piece that lets me get out early if you happen to get through all the way without doing a single switch. Does everyone see that? You're going to work this through at home. Now let's look at a pass. For j equals 0, j less than n minus pass minus 1, j plus plus. Okay. Let's take over here. J is my left pointer finger. So it says like this. If J starts out 0. Now remember, this is x sub 0, isn't it? So if x sub 0 is greater than x sub 0 plus 1, that's this one. If that's true, I need to switch them. If x sub 0, this finger, is greater than x sub 0 plus 1, that's this finger, then I need to switch them. But that's false. They're not. So since this is not true, I'm back here. J plus plus. So J is now 1. If x sub 1, that's this one, is greater than x sub 1 plus 1, that's this one, then I need to switch them. But it is greater than, right? 48 is greater than 35. So it's true. So I need to switch them. So I make switched equals true, because I'm just going to switch them. Then I do my three statements. Remember my three statements to switch something? Whole equals what's in X sub J. X sub J is in what's in X sub J plus 1. And X sub J plus 1 gets what's in hold. What does that do? That takes this number and it puts it into... It takes this number and puts it in hold. It takes this number and puts it here. It takes what's in hold and puts it there. So now it's here. And then of course we continue and we'll have to switch it again the next time around. Okay? So there is your little switch. And we keep on doing it. Come back here. And we move over. So this is the pass. Moves over and over and over. And every time we find a number and the number right to its right greater, we need to switch them. We get to the end of the pass. We come back here. We still haven't made any switches on the next pass, and do that again. And each time, because we're doing only greater n minus pass plus 1, we're doing less and less switching, comparing. Does everyone see that? Now, what you really need to do is you need at home, first of all, to just draw an array, put in some jumbled numbers, and just do the bubble sort without the computer, without the program. Just make sure you see how it works. Then, trace that program through. And memorize the basic bubble sort. Now, most often on a test, you will not be asked directly to do the simple bubble sort, but you'll have to make some revision to it, which is a test that you understand it rather than just blind memorization. So let me give you an example. Suppose we change the story. Suppose I had a data file that contained a series of student IDs, okay, and grades. In other words, the IDs were numbers like 235, 127, 291, and this person got a 90, and this person got an 85, and this person got a 70, and so on and so forth. And I had a file, okay, of such students, up to 1,000 students in the class. And I want to print out the list in code order, so that I can then post it on the black, on the wall, and you can see it grades up. So again, I have a file in which I've accumulated all the students' tests by their three-digit code and by their the test mark. And then I want to sort this out by code order and print out the results. What would you need to do in order to solve this problem? Let's write this as a set of English statements before we actually write the code. Very good. Two arrays. One is going to be an array to hold the IDs, and another array that's going to hold the grades. Excellent. Perfect. In other words, what you're visualizing for me is two arrays, individual arrays. They have no connection to each other, but they're individual arrays. Okay, and so on. And you will, in your mind, think of them as if they're side by side. I don't care if they're really not side by side, but we'll think of them that way, as if they're side by side. Excellent. So we need to create two arrays. Excellent. Step two. What's the next thing we're going to do? I don't know. I guess that's what we're trying to figure out. But we're not up to sorting them yet. What's the next thing we need to do? All I did was create two arrays. They're empty now. And I don't know how many numbers I have anyway yet, so I'm not even yet ready yet to sort them. So what's the next thing that I'm going to have to do? Read the numbers in, two at a time, until there are none left, put them into the arrays, and count them as we go along. Something you hear this like poem that I keep on saying over and over and over again. Read the numbers in this case I'm just saying adding two at a time, but read the numbers in, two at a time, until there are none left, putting them into an array, counting them as we go along. Read the numbers in two at a time until we are finished, counting them as we go along. Okay. Next. Now we've got that situation there. What do we want to do now? We've read the numbers in. We know how much they are. What do we want to do now? We want to sort them. Okay? So now we'll call the bubble sort. Will it be the exact bubble sort that I just did? Why not? What's going to be different about it? What am I sending? Let's think of it this way. What am I sending the bubble sort? Both, no, not two numbers. I'm sending it two complete arrays and the count. Before we sent it one array and the count, now we're sending it two arrays and the count. Because we don't want to sort the IDs without sorting the grades, otherwise someone else will end up with your grade, or vice versa. Okay? So we need to revise, bubble sort revised. We'll deal with that later on. Let's assume we did that. We sent both arrays to the bubble sort. When we're finished, what can you tell me about those arrays if the bubble sort did its job? What can you tell me about the arrays if the bubble sort did its job? They'll be in order. Very good. So what do you want to do now? Print them. What did you say? You said end? Print them. Shoot. The particular way you want to print them? Do you want to print first one and then the other? Is that what you want to do? Print one and then the other? Print them side by side. And then what? End. We're finished. Here's the steps. This is called pseudocode. Remember that word pseudocode, make-believe code? In every assignment that I've given you over the last three assignments, I've written the pseudocode for you in the strategy section. And if you follow that, you'd be able to write your program. But if you don't follow that and you try to solve the whole thing off the top, that's why I give you exactly, think of the program that I just gave you to do for next class, for the next time I see you. Not after the test, I mean after the break. Okay? I gave you the strategy, exactly how it's to be done. One of these days you'll have to do this on your own. Okay? Follow the strategy and you'll have no problem. So let's look at the solution to this and let's see how closely it matches that. So let me open, and this one is called Bubble Sort Grades, and let me show you the data file, which is called Bubble Sort Grades Text, and there are the numbers. Are they jumbled enough for you? I don't have to change this, okay? They're jumbled. Okay. So we don't have to look at this anymore. Let's look at this. Okay, we're going to create two arrays. Now, I assume I'm never going to have more than 100 students in the class. I could have said 1,000, but why waste space? Okay, there's no 1,000 seats in this room. So therefore, count int max number equals 100. And what was the first thing you had to do? Let's look at the main. It says create two arrays. Int code max number. That's this array. And int grade max number. That's this one. And I am count. I need to determine how many items there are going to be in the array. Are they really side by side in the computer? More than likely not. There is no side by side in the computer. But who cares? In my mind, they're side by side. That's all I need. Next step was read the numbers into the array one at a time until we are finished counting them as we go along. Here they are, exactly the same code that we had before. Okay, I don't know if you can see, let me just get the whole line in at one time. Count equals zero, while not infile.eof and infile is greater than code subcount, and infile, not greater, infile into code subcount, and infile into grade subcount, count plus plus. There are two things different in this code from what you've seen. The three times you've seen that mantra being written. One is you see that we're reading in two arrays, here and here. And number two is instead of using I, I'm using the variable count directly. Instead of saying I equals zero, then using I, then saying count equals I, I'm using count instead of I, saving on a variable right there. So when count is zero, the first two numbers go into the first slot of each array. Count plus plus, count is one. Get the next two numbers, put them in the slot of each of the two arrays. Do this over and over again until there are no numbers left to be read, in which case we now know how many there are, count. So this, what I highlight here, is step number two. After step number two, do I need the data file anymore? No. So I close the file right here. Good habit to get into is to close files as soon as you no longer need them. Most of the time we've closed the files at the end of the program, but if we had a very big program, when files are open, they're in danger. Bad things can happen to them. Therefore, it's a good habit to leave the files closed until you need them, and close them as soon as you're finished. So I open the file, read the numbers in, immediately close the file, and now I can go on. It's a good habit to get into. So that was step number two. We did step one, we did step two. Now we're ready to call the bubble sort. Okay, very similar to before. Bubble, except this time we're sending it two arrays and the count. So it's revised a little bit. Make sense? We'll get to the details later. Assuming it did its thing, we're now ready to print them out side by side. So, print the heading, see out, code, grade, for I equals 0, I less than count, see out, code, sub I, some spaces, grade, sub I, that prints them out, side by side, and as you can see when I run this program, before we look at bubble itself, let's just run it, nicely sorted, side by side, and now all we need to do is to look at the bubble sort that we've modified. Very, very similar to the one you're going to see. It's almost identical to the one that we did before. Let's look at its function prototype first. Here's the function prototype. Does that make sense? Look at it carefully. Void bubble, just as before. This time we're sending it two arrays. Okay, this is not the function prototype. I'm sorry, this is the function header. Where's the function prototype? Here's the function prototype. Sorry about that. Void bubble. We're sending it int bracket. We're sending it two arrays instead of one array. And an int, which represents the number of items, the count. Yes? Everybody with me? And now we'll go back to where we were a moment ago. Okay. Void bubble. Int code bracket. Int grade bracket, int n. Of course, do I need a call by reference for the first two parameters? Because they're arrays, so they are call by reference. I don't need to explicitly say so. They are call by reference. I will be switching the arrays. N is a call by value. I'm not changing the number of items. Now look, the routine itself is exactly the same. Hole, j, pass, bool, switch, all this is true, the same exact thing. For j equals 0, here's the only change in this piece right over here. You asked me before, how do I switch them both? Well, look. If these two are out of order, I want to switch those two, and I also want to switch these two. So if code sub j is greater than code sub j plus 1, that means they're out of order. So I want to switch three statements to switch these two numbers. And then another three statements right over here to switch these two numbers. That's it. Everything else is exactly the same. Tell me, if I changed my mind and now I wanted to sort them not by ID, but by grade, what change would you make to this program to sort them by grade instead of sorting them by ID? You only have to make one change to the whole program. Change the if statement. Instead of saying if code sub j is greater than code sub j plus 1, you would write if grade sub j is greater than grade sub j plus 1. That's it. No other change would be needed in the entire program, and now it would sort it by grade rather than by code. Suppose there was, just for argument's sake, something called grade 1, and another thing called grade 2. What changes would you make to the bubble sort so that it would now switch, and I still want to do it by code. What changes would you make to switch so it would sort all three arrays? You'd need another three statements, and you'd have to make one other little change. you'd have to have code in grade 1 and another one in grade 2. You have to send it all three arrays. Everybody with me? And if I had 4, and so on and so forth. Now, you can see if I've had 5, I would have to send it 5 things. It's getting to be awkward, isn't it? If you have 2 arrays side by side, or 3 arrays side by side, or 4 arrays side by side, or 5 arrays side by side, it's no longer beginning to look like a one-dimensional array. What's it beginning to look like? In other words, you wouldn't call it a vector, an array. What might you call it? A table. Right? In other words, there was some way to combine this so that there are just one big thing, having lots of rows and several different columns. Give it one name, called roster. And in the first column would be your IDs. The second column would be your first test. The next column would be your second test. Third column would be your third test. Last column would be your averages, let's say. That's a table. Does everyone see that? Well, we have a name for that. It's called a two-dimensional array. A two-dimensional array has just not rows, which is what we call the slots before, but now it also has columns. Okay? And we will be looking at two-dimensional arrays a little bit later in a little bit more detail, but not right now. Are there any questions? Okay, we can stop here.